All right, now's the big moment. It is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. She is our treasurer. Let's give her a warm Valley Group welcome to Sandra.
Okay, my head is back. Here I am. Fix me up, Mike. I'm good. Okay. Again, I'm Sandra. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sandra.
Deep breath. First of all, I just want to welcome everybody new or anyone who feels like they're new. I'm not new anymore, but sometimes I still feel like I'm new after all these years. And they told me when I was new to go to 90 meetings in 90 days before I made a decision that would affect the rest of my life. I took that to heart and I did that. And, you know, the only thing that has kept me sober all these years, the bottom line, is I didn't drink one day at a time. And I went to a bunch of meetings, and I just didn't drink between meetings. So, you know, if you're in a place, because I've been in there, that place where you're like, I don't know if this is for me. I don't know if I want to stay sober. I don't know anything. I would just, when I was new, I would just stay sober until the next meeting. And that worked really well for me. And if it meant I needed to go to 3 meetings in a day, I went to 3 meetings in a day. And that worked out. And I hung out with alcoholics all the time because that was safe for me. I did not know how to be sober and by myself. I didn't know how to be sober and in a group of people. And so I just took a lot of direction, and I did what I could do. I did a lot of things really badly and wrong, but I did everything that I could to the best of my ability. And they said, be of service. I found a job. When I was new, what that looked like was cleaning coffee pots, pouring coffee, carrying around cream and sugar, cleaning ashtrays. We used to smoke in meetings. We don't do that anymore. The first meeting I went to, and I'll talk about my story, but it just made me laugh, was at a hospital. It was the Friday night Palmdale Hospital speaker meeting, and which the hospital doesn't exist anymore either. But there was about 200 people in the room. There was a care unit on the campus there. And the entire hospital cafeteria was filled with smoke. So my sobriety is July 7th, 1989. I got sober when I was 3 years old. That was supposed to be a joke. Obviously, I don't look that young anymore. But so I actually grew up in Palmdale. I was born in San Bernardino, California. I'm the oldest of 6 children. I have 5 younger brothers, which makes me the only girl. And we moved to the Antelope Valley, Palmdale, Lancaster, high desert, desert rat girl when I was about 6 years old. And I grew up there, and we lived in one of those stucco track houses that was brand new in 1979. And I grew up in alcoholism. My dad's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He got sober 6 months before I did. My father, for all intents and purposes, introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. So in a nutshell, none of my brothers are sober. Some of them, they all drink. Some of them make it look really, really good. And some of them make it look really, really bad. But for me, alcohol took me to a place that I don't ever want to go back to again. I don't want to feel the desperation and the depression and the hopelessness ever again. Not interested. That does not mean I haven't wanted to drink during my sobriety, because I have definitely wanted to drink. And I remember when that first happened, when I was newer, and over the years it's popped back up. You know, I thought something was wrong, that I was doing something wrong, that my recovery was broken. I wasn't doing the steps right. I wasn't doing sponsorship right. I wasn't doing meetings right. I wasn't doing service right. And then I finally realized after a while that if an alcoholic wants to drink, that's probably normal. It's for an alcoholic to have a desire to drink. That's normal. It's okay if that happens. But I've been given tools and in this program to help me walk through that, to think that through. And I haven't had to, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for a few days now. So anyways, I grew up with my dad drinking. My dad's a high-functioning alcoholic. He, and I don't call him an alcoholic. He calls himself an alcoholic. So he worked for L.A. County Department of Communications, and we spent a lot of time drunk driving all over L.A. County fixing radio towers. He would work on those repeaters up on Hazard and MacDill. And he had the keys to the Ritter Ranch, and we'd drive those windy roads, and we'd cut firewood, and we'd go hunting. And anytime my dad was drunk, he liked to drive. So we always were going places. I had a huge resentment at him for many, many years, way into my sobriety, about the whole drunk driving thing. But then I realized later on, and this is what's changed as a result of this program, how the steps have helped me view things differently, is that my dad never left us at home. He never left. He wanted us kids with him. That was an epiphany for me. It was scary. It was dangerous. He put our lives at risk. I have horrible PTSD on being in a windy road, even today, stone cold sober with anyone else driving. But he never left us. He wanted us with him. He always wanted his kids hanging out with him up in the mountains. And that's the kind of guy he was. The only time he was miserable to be around was when he was sober. He was great when he was drunk. But I still always believe that if my dad just got sober, all of our family's problems would be solved. If he just wouldn't drink, everything would be okay. I believe that to the core of my being. My first drinks were at family gatherings. My mom's side of the family and my dad's side of the family drank very differently. My mom's side was fancy, and they had dinner parties, and they drank out of glass. And they filled it up half full, and then they just kept refilling it. And my dad's family was messy, and I liked both. It didn't matter. I liked being around people when they were drinking. I thought drinking was cool. I always wanted to be older, being the oldest of all the kids. I didn't really relate to the whole kid thing. To this day, I would never want to repeat being a child, an adolescent, a teenager. I'd never want to go back to my 20s ever again. Life has gotten easier the older I've gotten, but I wanted to be like the grown-ups. I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be respected. I didn't want to have to earn it, but that's what I wanted, and I wanted it now. My fancy Nana, she would offer me drinks. And boy, I felt like I was the specialist thing in the world when I was allowed to drink with the grown-ups. My first good drunk was also a blackout. And the parents left. I planned a party. Lots of bad things happened. The bottom line is, I came to in the same chair my dad would pass out in every single night, in the same position he passed out in every night. And when I came to in the morning from that first good drunk, the way I wanted to drink, that I had been waiting for and looking forward to for so long, everyone was gone in the morning and I was alone. And I missed the party. I don't really remember it. I'm sure I had a good time. But that's kind of how it started from day one, and it just kept going like that. I never crossed an invisible line. When I got sober, people used to say, oh, you're so lucky you got sober so young. And I was mortified and devastated and horrified because I felt like I was gypped out of years of successful, beautiful, wonderful drinking. And I didn't understand what they were talking about, that I was lucky that I got sober when I was young. I thought they were lucky that they got to drink for 20 years longer than I did. I thought that was cool. But ultimately, I just once that first good one happened, the goal, it was on. It was like the goal was to just do that over and over and over and often as possible that I possibly could. And being a underage person, that wasn't easy to do. But all of my energies and all of my intelligence focused in on that. And my drinking chose who I hung out with. It chose how I spent my time. It completely rearranged the priorities in my life. And it was kind of sad, actually, because I was kind of a halfway decent human being before I started drinking. I was relatively successful on this planet. I went to school. I did what I was supposed to do. I don't think I was happy by any stretch of the imagination, but I looked kind of okay on the outside. And when I started drinking, the problem is I had this like need and want and desire to look good, smell good, act good, and have people like me, but my drinking was ridiculous. I was ridiculous. And every single area of my life, I was ridiculous. And I didn't have the ability to fulfill commitments. I didn't have the ability to tell the truth. Drinking decided what I did. So, hey, by the way, sorry I keep looking down. It's kind of embarrassing. I've never done this before. But I did write some notes because I've learned over the years that I'm attentional and I go on tangents. So I'm trying not to go on a tangent. I don't want to talk about something ridiculous for 20 minutes that doesn't matter, but I have a tendency to do stuff like that. So I took notes and I'm not apologizing. Excuse me. So let's see here. I said all that. So what ultimately happened, though, was that I became very depressed. I don't really know how to put it any other way. I started drinking, and I stopped functioning, and then I got depressed, and I stayed depressed. And I became basically suicidally depressed every single day. My GPA went from a 3.5 to a 0.5. All I wanted to do was drink and kill myself when I was sober. That was just kind of how I walked around. And that somehow landed me to my first trip to a rehab. I got out of that rehab and I was there for a couple weeks. Very soon after that, my dad got sober. And just a couple weeks after that, I was hospitalized for a suicide attempt. I spent 3 days in the hospital. I got lectured by the doctor that my liver was enlarged and I needed to stop drinking. I thought that was very annoying. My mom, in her good nature, that was trying to do everything she could, called the Episcopalian priest to bring communion, which I chuckle now because I actually got to drink wine in the hospital after a suicide attempt, which was pretty cool. So I put two and two together years later. It took me years because I was so damn self-obsessed. I think my dad had like 25 days when I tried to kill myself. My dad was brand new sober. So if you've got a crazy kid and you're new, look what can happen. So they can stay sober and it can work out. So anyways, so that was just drama. And after I got out of the hospital, I just decided that I wasn't going to try anymore. And it actually got better. I stopped caring. I surrendered to my disease. I said, I'm just going to drink and not care. I wasn't very good at not caring, but I decided that's what I was going to do. And so I tried really hard to just do everything I could to keep the pressures at bay, to leave me alone so I could drink the way I wanted to. So I pretty much got up around 4 o'clock every day and I cleaned the house. My parents were split up at this point. I'd clean the house. I'd make sure everything looked like it was in order. My dad would get home from work about 5:30. I'd be gone by the time he got home. I would stay out all night. I would get in a couple hours before he would wake up to go to work. And I just did that over and over and over again. I just kept myself away from anyone who cared and anyone who might say anything. It wasn't that they cared. They were in the way of my drinking. So I just stayed away from my parents. I stayed away from my mother. I stayed away from my father. They were crazy and they were assholes. And that's how I saw it. And so I just did that. And that's what I did. And I just drank. And every once in a while, my dad would catch me. And, you know, he wouldn't say anything other than, do you want to go to a meeting? And, you know, he asked me that repeatedly over a period of I don't even know how long. And finally, I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting. I just kind of wanted him to leave me alone. Actually, he didn't say I wanted to go to a meeting. He was creative. He said he needed help with his coffee commitment at the meeting. So he needed my help for his coffee commitment at the meeting. And I was like, okay. And it was true. He kind of did need help. It was for that Friday night Palmdale Hospital speaker meeting with 200 people. And it kind of took like three people to make like four pots of coffee. It was crazy, the job he did. By the way, he did that in his first year of sobriety, which I just like sharing it because it's adorable. He didn't have a driver's license, so he rode his 10-speed to the meeting, and his sponsor had all the coffee stuff in his truck. And his sponsor would drive all the supplies to the meeting, and my dad would ride his bike to the meeting. He didn't even get a ride. And I just thought he was whatever. Desperate, obviously. Thank goodness. It's amazing what desperation will do for you. You ride your 10-speed 5 miles to a meeting and have your sponsor bring the stuff so you can do your commitment. My dad got sober and he stayed sober. And that was it. Was one of the examples I had. So I kept doing what I was doing, and I kept going to these meetings every now and then. That first meeting I went to, though, where I helped him, I did hear the message to the point that I did not want to get sober by any stretch of the imagination, but I could relate. And I felt eerily comfortable sitting in a meeting. I didn't feel edgy. I didn't feel like I needed to run away. I felt kind of safe. And I never really felt safe anywhere. Not with the people I drank with, not when I was alone, not with my family, but I kind of felt okay sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I noticed that. I kept going to meetings, and I did raise my hand as an alcoholic. When they say, you know, is there anyone, what do they say? Are there any other alcoholics present? I would raise my hand. I would say that. Yeah. Good. Just like that. And I kind of knew from the first meeting that that was my problem. I just didn't have any interest in getting sober. I mean, the thought of getting sober was just impossible. It just didn't make any sense. My dad was a drunk, not me. He was the problem, not me. So what happened is alcohol stopped working. If it still worked, I'd probably still be drinking, to be honest. I quit getting the effect. And it kind of happened all at once. I drank. I didn't get drunk. That's simple. Not exciting. No huge event happened. No massive emotional breakdowns. Although I did kind of have a breakdown, but I'm a girl, so that's normal to have breakdowns on a regular basis. But it just quit working. And it quit working, get this. My dad had a girlfriend, because my dad likes women, but that's cool, I guess. So he had one of his girlfriends. he went out of town to go like race in a dirt bike race or something, because my dad races motorcycles to this day. And he left his girlfriend to babysit me. Now, mind you, she's not really sober either. So her and I like drank the whole time he was gone, which is, God, those were the days. And but it quit working when I was with her. It quit working that weekend he was gone. And it's just so funny to me. That was a couple days before my belly button birthday. My mom had this grand scheme to take me to this sober camp out at, I can't remember the name of the state beach down south, but it was at a state beach. And there was a bunch of sober young people there. And it was 3 days long. It was a Friday, a Saturday, and a Sunday. And my belly button birthday was on Saturday. And I had no desire to be sober on my birthday. But when I got home from that campout, I had 3 days of sobriety. And I had a head full of recovery. And I had witnessed a bunch of other young people who had stayed sober. And I believed what you guys told me, that you would gladly refund my misery. So I said, okay, I'm going to just not drink one day at a time, and I'm going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I'm just going to like do a science experiment and see what happens. And each day that I didn't drink, I felt better. And each day I went to meetings, I felt better. And I started to get hope, and I hadn't had hope in as long as I can remember. And that was as magical as it was. I just started doing what you people told me to do, and I just didn't drink. And I didn't plan on staying sober a long time. I figured I'd probably drink again, but that's just not what ended up happening. And I think it was because I learned that it was going to get worse. And I also never forgot my last drunk. I never forgot that it didn't work anymore. And I believed what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me and taught me. So when I was new, I was basically a kid, and I was sober with a bunch of old people who were old enough most of them to be my parents. I was incredibly rebellious, incredibly self-centered, self-righteous. I wanted to fit in. I wanted you to like me, you know, and that was good and bad because I wanted to fit in and I wanted you to like me. If people in AA said to me, hey, we're going to go take a meeting into Camp Scott Scudder, you want to go? Sure, I'll go. Now, mind you, I did not want to go to Camp Scott Scudder, which is a camp like alternative to jail camp. Has anyone ever been to Scott Scudder? No one from LA County? Okay. So because I didn't really want to do that, but I would go anyways because I just wanted to do whatever you people told me to do because I wanted to stay sober, and B, I wanted you to like me, or maybe I wouldn't get to stay because I didn't have anywhere else to go. I'd been going to therapy for God knows how long. I'd been through one rehab. Now, mind you, I went again when I was 6 months sober. But I just wanted to do whatever you guys told me to do because I just wanted to get this. And I was starting to feel a little bit better. So I did all the things people asked me to do. And I went to all the events. And I needed to have fun. I was a child. I had no responsibilities. And I needed to have fun. I wouldn't have called myself a child then. But now I'm like, I was a child. I was a teenager. So I was a kid. So let's see. I had a bunch of sponsors. I went from sponsor to sponsor to sponsor. They told me that I had to have a sponsor. So I'd get a sponsor, and then I wouldn't call the sponsor. or no, I wouldn't call them. And then I would be so embarrassed and ashamed that I never called them that I would just get another one. And I just did that like for a long time. I managed to, in my first 3 years, do the steps twice. I went through the steps two times in my first 3 years. I did two, that means two separate inventories, neither of which were searching and fearless. They were definitely immoral inventories, not moral inventories. And I can't even say I went through the steps because I did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and then stopped. And if you do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and you stop, you're going to get really, really miserable. Just hint, hint. Like, don't stop at 5. It's bad. So, I mean, you might feel better, but I didn't. Me personally, I felt worse. I felt naked and ashamed. And then one of the people that I shared my fifth step with, who wasn't my sponsor, it was just some random person that somebody found that said, oh, this person will listen to your fifth step. I don't even know who it was. She burned my fifth step. And I was like, wait a second. Like, I did all this work. I spent all this time sharing all this stuff with you, and now you're burning it as if it's unimportant. I did not get it. I mean, I guess that's supposed to be a good thing to burn an inventory for some people, but I experienced it like rather traumatic. It was kind of a traumatic event for me. I later learned down the road from good sponsorship and the book that we actually use our inventory to finish the rest of the steps. So if it's burned, you don't have like your 8-step list. So you can burn it, but make sure you copy down the information you need first and then burn it so you can use it. Anyway, so I went from sponsor to sponsor. So the bottom line is even though I was sober, I wasn't in active alcoholism, my thinking was crazy, I wanted people to like me, and I went and I just kind of switched addictions to a bunch of other stuff. When I was 15 months sober, I got married. I had 4 children in rapid succession. When I was 21 years old, I was 6 years sober, batshit crazy, not going to enough meetings, not being sponsored, and working at Red Robin in Colorado Springs, serving alcohol with a bartender that thought I should probably drink with him. Now, mind you, I had 3 kids at home and a husband I hated. It was bad. But I knew I had a head full of AA and I knew what I needed to do. And I did it. I have a choice today because I'm sober. I have a choice. I didn't have a choice when I was drinking because alcohol ran everything. I had the information and I learned that I could go home with my tail between my legs. And I can do what you people taught me. And what you told me is that I needed to find, this is my interpretation, everyone has a different interpretation, I needed to find one person on the planet that I could tell the truth to. I needed to do the steps again before I made any major decisions that would affect the rest of my life, like drinking. If I'm going to drink, that's great. But first, I'm going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I'm going to go through the steps again. And then if I still want to drink after that, great. And that was my plan. So I took my butt and my 3 kids back to California, moved in with my mother, and spent every morning at the 6:30 a.m. Attitude Modification Group at the Grange Hall in Quartz Hill. And because that was the only meeting I could go to because I had all these kids, and there was no like babysitting money to be. So I went to that meeting and I got a sponsor, and it was a he because I couldn't tell the truth to a she. And so I told the truth to he, and he took me through the steps, and he had a working knowledge of the big book, and that's what I needed. I've never had a male sponsor since, but that first time it saved my ass. And to this day, I don't know if I would have stayed sober unless I would have worked worked with him. And I'm super, super grateful. He was the husband of my very best girlfriend who got sober a year after I did. And that worked out fairly well for the few months that we worked together. So let's see here. I have like 10 minutes and I'm about halfway through. Isn't that awesome? I said some of this stuff already. So what I think I'm going to do is skip over some of this and see what comes in here. But what I wanted to really quickly do is just kind of go through how I apply the steps in my daily life now. Because ever since that happened when I was 6 years sober, I just kind of have been on this path. And the beginning of that path really was changing how I, changing my spiritual life. Because I would go to meetings and I would listen to people talk about God and their spirituality and their higher power. And I would be like, okay, that's so beautiful and wonderful. And I don't have that. I don't get that. I don't know what you're talking about. But I wanted it because it looked and smelled good. Like those people seem pretty happy and I kind of wanted to have what they had. But I would try over and over again to use other people's higher powers. They had a cool higher power. I figured I would just steal theirs because they told me I could do that in AA. But what I found for me is that never worked because that wasn't honest. That was just a bunch of BS. And I needed something that I needed a higher power that I could do business with. And so after that first round of the steps, you know, I just started working on that. I realized that that was kind of key to me finding sanity and serenity. So I did spend a lot of time, and that has continued to change and evolve. But I found that, like, kind of at the core of everything is my spiritual connection and having a relationship with a higher power. Because ultimately, like, all the stuff I get myself into, which I get myself into all kinds of problems to this day, the only way I can get out of them is to rely on my higher power, A, and also to tell on myself. So I have to have someone I can tell the truth to that I can tell on myself to, which is really scary because it's embarrassing and I'm ashamed and all this fear and all this yucky stuff. So one, I don't need to tell five people. I only need one. One human and my higher power. And if I got one human I can tell the truth to about all the stuff I'm ashamed of and I'm fearful of, and I've got a higher power that I can turn my will and my life over to, and I can say, okay, I created this mess. Please, I'm willing. I'll do anything. And then I actually follow through with that. There's some hope for me. That's what's been the consistent thing over the years that I've always come back to. So, you know, I didn't look anything up. I just have to say I'm kind of proud of myself. Like, I didn't even look up the steps. I didn't open the big book or the 12 and 12. I was like, I'm just going to go off my head and go, okay, what do the steps mean to me? Step one, powerlessness over everything. For me, my alcoholism was just the tip of the iceberg. I am powerless over people, places, things, my 6 children, my husband, my ex-husband, my parents, my employers, past employers, my clients, people in meetings, how they behave, whether you like me or not, my feelings. I'm powerless over everything. And all those things can cause, to this day, stone cold sober, my life to become unmanageable when I start giving them power. If I'm afraid of what someone in the back of the room thinks of me, I'm giving them my power, and my life becomes unmanageable because I'm not present with you people here anymore now because I'm thinking about what that person thinks of me. And that is pure pain. This girl can't do pure pain. She can't, because every time I get into that place of thinking about me all the time and how I've am in this world, I want to drink. I got to numb that shit out now. So I have to do something about it. So I'm powerless over everything. Left to my own devices, step two, I'm crazy. Completely. Most of the time I am crazy. no big deal. There's still a solution. But my best thinking got me to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. My best thinking got me married when I was 15 years old, having four children back to back. My best thinking had me living in a tent with three kids in Santa Rosa for 90 days. My best thinking kept me unemployed. My best thinking kept me uneducated. My best thinking kept me lonely, without friends, without a sponsor, without a higher power. My best thinking is like, I could figure this out. I can figure this out if I just try harder. Because I'm a good person, don't you know? Because I am a good person. I know that now today, too. I'm a pretty damn good person. I'm pretty nice, kind of not an asshole. I like to be friendly with people. But my best thinking, we've heard, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Yep. Well, I made myself a living hell in and out of sobriety because I'm crazy. It's okay, though, because I got steps. No big deal. Step three, hope. Third step gave me hope. I never had it, and it's the only time I do, is when I'm practicing step three. Step four, willingness. Step five, honesty. Step six, humility. Step seven, faith. Step eight, open-mindedness. Step nine, patience. For me, my ninth step amends, I didn't know about all of them the first time I went through the steps, or the second time, or the third time, or the fourth time. I've done the steps a bunch of times because I'm crazy, so I have to keep doing the steps. One of the amends that I became really clear to me that I needed to make probably around 12 years of sobriety, because it takes me a long time, I didn't come across the person I needed to make. I had no contact with this person. I ended up making amends with this girl 5 years ago. I think I was 22 years of sobriety. I was 10 years. After I realized I needed to make the amends, I actually was able to make the amends. I didn't even realize I had to make it till I was 12 years sober. So all of my amends, all the steps have just been this like evolution. It's not like I can do them. I'm fixed. We're all better now and we can move on with our life. It's not worked that way for me. I'm constantly, that more will be revealed. Layers of the onion. How annoying is that? I don't like layers of the onion, but more will be revealed. It's a lovely thing. I get more information. I get clearer. I look back and go, oh, my dad didn't want to leave us at home. He liked us. Wow, that's cool. As opposed to, you know, that bastard drove us around in the car and he didn't care about us. And that's all just this evolution of viewing things from a little bit different angle. And every time I do the steps again, I have a little bit different view. Step 10, perseverance. Oh, I want to mention about step nine. Don't do amends without a sponsor helping you. You will make it worse. End of this. That's it. Nothing else to say on that. Step 11, spirituality. My favorite steps are 6 and 7. Read them if you don't know why. Go read 6 and 7 and the 12 and 12. They'll be your new favorites too. They are the steps that remind me over and over again that I can't. My higher power can. And that I can maybe hopefully find some humility in all of this. That I don't have a clue. I never will. It's okay. Thank you. Thank you, God, for helping me. And thank you that maybe there's some space for me to be of service if I can get a little bit better. Number 12, service. So I kind of am out of time, but, you know, when I was new, I used to listen to the ninth step promises. They read them in meetings all the time, and they would talk about a new freedom and a new happiness, and we will not regret the past and wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. You know, I don't remember all of them, but We will see that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And they are not extravagant promises. They are not. And but I also learned, you know, down after a few years too, that the ninth step was, it says we will be amazed before we are halfway through. And they meant halfway through with the steps. Or with the amends, depending on how you read that and depending on how you interpret that. But the bottom line is I get to get those things when I take action on my own behalf. So just to wrap it up and give and just tell you where I'm at now. All the brothers, they're still drinking and being cool. I had four babies. I adopted one, and I got another one through the gift of a remarriage. So there's six, three boys and three girls. Johnny's an electrical and electrician and a plumber, the oldest. He's 25. Mary got a bachelor's of science in biochemistry at Chico State. Then she came to work for me as a tax accountant, and now she's on a leave of absence serving with the Utah Conservation Corps. Hopefully she'll come back and work for me because she makes a fabulous tax accountant. Sean Patrick is a painter. He works with his dad in Colorado. Paige is serving for the United States Navy in Great Lakes, Illinois. Devin is a carpenter. He's my stepson. He lives with his girlfriend in Missouri. And Paige, Paige Casey left for boot camp for the Army about 2 weeks ago. Casey's the one I adopted. My husband and I adopted her when she was just over 18 years old, so we wouldn't have to deal with all of the court stuff, and we wanted her to have a family. She did not have a family. So she's 21 now, and she has embarked on a journey. So she's in Fort Lost in the Woods, Missouri. While those kids were all teenagers, I completed my bachelor's of science in accounting online because it was the only way I could do it. I worked full time. I went to school full time. I'm in the last. I'm working on my master's thesis for my MBA at Fresno State right now. And I have this little tiny humble house on Northwest 3rd. If you ever drive on the corner of 3rd and Pearl, right across from the cute church, that's my house. It has lots of cool Halloween decorations in the window. I love my little house in my neighborhood in this wonderful town. I spent 10 years in Colorado. I spent 10 years in San Diego. I was there. I took myself those places. I lived in Breckenridge, at the ski areas. I've lived in Oregon. I'm here too. And I can be of service here, and I can relax a little bit here, and I can find some serenity here. So I have wonderful relationships with those kids today. I talk to my mom and my dad all the time, which is really annoying, but I do it anyways because they're still really weird. And I'm going to go help my mom. My mom's getting divorced again for the third or fourth time. I can't remember. So I'm going to go help her unpack in a couple weeks down in San Diego. And, it's an honor and a privilege that I get to be a daughter today and not completely wrapped up in me. And thank you for listening to me talk.